This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, happy Monday. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. This weekend I was down in Bandon. Actually, I was staying in Bandon. I was speaking in Coquille. This is all in Coos County. In fact, we drove through and spent some time in Coos Bay, Oregon, down on the southern part of the Oregon seacoast. And a tip of the hat to the folks in KBBR, which carry our program in Coos Bay, and doing a fundraiser for the Democratic Party. And we spent a fair amount of time with Bill and Katie Bradbury. Bill is the Secretary of State for Oregon. In fact, he made us a great breakfast over at his home yesterday morning, and he's also an uncommitted superdelegate, and expressed his concern about how polarized people are becoming, how rigidified people are becoming in their positions for and against Obama and Clinton. And then on the way back home over the weekend, Louise, Sunday as we were driving home, two quick stories about that. The first has to do with the vehicle. This was incredible. General Motors is one of our sponsors right now, and so they're loaning me a car for 2 weeks every month, a different car. And this month it was the Chevy Tahoe Hybrid. Now, this is a giant. This is a tank of an SUV, but it's a hybrid. And what was amazing is driving this thing on the highway, and it's got this little instantaneous mileage thing. And when you're just coasting, it switches from V8 mode to V4 mode. And I'm looking at this going, whoa, wait a minute. I'm getting 35 miles to the gallon in an SUV here going along in V4 mode. It's only apparently running on four cylinders. So anyhow, that was cool, and it had satellite radio in it, and XM, which were on, as well as Sirius, and we were listening to all the right-wing shows on the way back, which was fascinating. And right across the board, they were either spending all of their time trying to portray, and one of these hosts on one of these right-wing shows just explicitly, some guy named Willie, Willie Cunningham, I think, Bill Cunningham, was explicitly saying that Obama was essentially a secret Muslim and a supporter of Farrakhan and all this stuff. I mean, it was just so incredibly toxic and basically encouraging, and he was broadcasting from within Indiana on a local station that's in Indiana, encouraging people to get out and vote for Hillary Clinton. And I was just, you know, taken aback by all of these right-wing shows that a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, were trashing Hillary Clinton. I mean, just absolutely trashing her. And, you know, we had Dick Morris and others on this program just taking her apart. And now they're all singing her praises and trashing Barack Obama. And that was a fascinating dynamic. But the thing that I thought was most interesting was the talk that I gave, not interesting about my own talk, but the response to it, the talk that I gave in Coquille at this Democratic Party fundraiser. The reason I was down there was this $25 plate, and it was, you know, a great meal that was served. Local folks put this thing together for the Democratic Party of Coos County, Oregon, and it was the biggest turnout that they've ever had. There was just something short of 400 people showed up. And, you know, in a small rural county, or a large county, but a small population in a small town. And the talk that I get, I started out telling this story about how, and I tell this to you in part because I think it was, the response I got was, you know, that was really an important story. I started out telling a story about how 10, 15 years ago, I don't remember the year, but I think it was about 15 years ago, myself and a friend of mine, John Rady, who is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School and the author of Driven to Distraction, the co-author of a number of books on attention deficit disorder, and then I've written 7 books on that, and he wrote the foreword to one of my books, ADD Success Stories, and John and I have known each other for years and years, And we were invited to an Apache reservation in Arizona because the population there, about 10,000 folks living on this reservation, and the schools are just crashing. I mean, the community itself is experiencing the results of 400 years of basically the genocide of the Native American peoples in North America. And it's ongoing. It's not as explicit, but it's, you know, culturally certainly ongoing. 50-60% unemployment in this community. I mean, the community is just being devastated. And in any case, we went in and we worked with their schools and the social workers and the police and on these issues of learning disabilities and how to make the schools work. And as a result of this, I got to know a number of the people in that community. And one of them invited me back a few months later to a three-day ceremony for his best friend's daughter's coming of age. And where for 3 days the community, I was the only white guy there, but basically the community came out and danced with this girl. And I don't mean dancing in our tradition, in the the kind of Western tradition of square dancing kind of thing or something like that, basically chanting from sunup until sundown for 3 days with this girl. And every night the men and the women would separate and do sweats for purification. And I was doing this sweat with a group of these Apache men. There was 6, 7, 8 of us. And we had done this long, this 36-stone sweat. And afterwards, we were just, you know, our bodies are steaming and we're out in the desert and it's kind of cold and this crystal clear sky, black night. It was about midnight. And we're sitting around the fire and just, you know, now it's time to just blow off steam. And we're just talking, you know, guy talk and telling stories to each other and making jokes. And the Apaches were making Hopi jokes. And, you know, it's like I didn't know any Hopi jokes. And I can tell you, I've been, Louise and I spent our 25th wedding anniversary on the second Mesa with the Hopi community, or members of the Hopi community, a number of activist members of the Hopi community. And they tell jokes about the Navajo, and it's, you know, it's all good-natured. But I didn't know any Hopi to tell jokes about, and so I grew up in the culture of the put-down joke, you know, the Seinfeld kind of thing, you know, how do we do contemporary humor. And so I made a joke at the expense of the guy sitting opposite me around the fire. And all 7 guys around the fire all of a sudden just went totally silent. And I got it that I had made some kind of terrible mistake. You know, I had committed a sin. I had offended this guy in front of his, or embarrassed him, in front of his peers. And there was this long silence, and I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to, you know, they're going to ask me to leave, and I've humiliated my friend Paul who invited me here, and I've committed a sin. You know, I'm going to be punished. And because that's the culture that I came out of. And after a few long and painful minutes, I'm not even sure it was that long, but the oldest guy in the group, sort of like he knew it was his obligation, he roused himself and he said, you know, I remember when I was young and stupid and back in boarding school back in the 1940s, and I made a comment that really hurt a friend of mine right in front of everybody. And he tells the story of what he did, and he tells the story of how he made it right. And then the guy next to him says, yeah, I remember one time when I, and he tells a story about how he embarrassed somebody and how he made it right. And then the guy that I embarrassed tells his story of how he did this and he made it right. And all the way around the circle, every single one of them had a story to tell like this. And finally it got back around to me. And by that point, I had learned 2 things. One was how to make it right with this guy. In other words, they had taught me what I had to say and do with the guy that I had embarrassed and hurt in front of his peers. They taught me what to do. But second, and perhaps most important, is I got it that this is a culture that has survived for 10,000 years without police, without prisons, without jails, without an FBI or a CIA and all that stuff, and survived intact because what they're about is not punishing sinners. They're about healing and bringing people back into the community. And that's what we as Democrats have to do. The Democratic Party, at the end of this primary, has to be prepared to heal. And I get emails all the time from Hillary partisans and Obama partisans saying, you can't believe how evil the other person is, and here's the 26 pieces of proof, or you can't, you know, what's it going to take to convince you how sick or toxic this person is? And I'm telling you, that is the most destructive stuff. Because one of these two people is going to be the nominee, and the other person is going to campaign for the nominee. And we have to be supporting them both. We have to pull together as a party, even now. In fact, I want to share a couple of clips. Hillary Clinton spoke to this just this weekend. God bless her. I want to share a couple of clips about this and take this to this larger issue of how do we heal the Democratic Party in this hour. Then in our second hour, we're going to hear from David Horowitz, who's going to tell us the Democrats are the party of defeat. We'll get to that as we continue.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Want to shout out.
So in a way, what I'm suggesting is that as Americans, as a culture, as a society that is grounded in the, to a large extent, in the European and to some extent Christian and in large part, frankly, I think, you know, the idea of sin and punishment is one that has been embraced by Christianity, to some extent Judaism, the major religions of the world. Islam, that there is an important lesson for us to learn from indigenous people all around the world, which is that communities, in order to survive over the long term, have to put healing ahead of punishment. So whoever is the winner in this, ultimately in this primary, we all have to embrace. And here's Hillary Clinton saying that she's going to do that, even if it's Barack Obama. This is such an important statement by her, and I salute her for saying this.
I will tell you this. If Senator Obama is the nominee, you better believe I'll work my heart out for him.
And she then went on to say, you know, and of course, I know that he'll work his heart out for me, too. So this is the important thing. And Howard Dean on Fox News this weekend, and Louise and I heard this live as we were driving back from Coquille. Howard Dean basically calling out Fox News and saying, you know, your news coverage is not fair and balanced. Now, you know, since that time, or not since Howard Dean said this, but over the last month or so, we have heard a couple of people on Fox News say, well, what fair and balanced means is that we present the conservative right-wing Republican view to balance the liberal media. Right? But nonetheless, here was
party to boycott Fox debates and all the other programs during the last year, and thereby boycott getting your message out to the millions of people who watch?
No, I think it was the right thing to do, because there are some things in the news department that have really been shockingly biased, and I think that's wrong.
Yeah, so, and he's right. He's right. He's absolutely right. At the same time, the Republican Party, and this is a story that it kind of blows my mind how uncovered this is. Yes, John McCain has enough delegates to win, but Ron Paul hasn't dropped out of the race yet. And he has millions of dollars in his war chest, and he's continuing to raise millions of dollars. And there has been a virtual media blackout on this. And just breaking that blackout briefly, on May 5th here, Ron Paul was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer.
Don't you want to see a Republican in the White House?
Well, that's secondary to wanting the Constitution defended and wanting the country to go in the right direction, bringing peace around the world, having sound money and balanced budgets. All the things the Republicans, you know, traditionally have stood for. That's more important than just having a Republican. We have to know what we believe in.
What's your biggest problem with Senator McCain?
And see, this, first of all, Ron Paul says, well, you know, it's more important. It's almost like he's setting himself up to run as a libertarian or a constitutional party or one of these, although the Constitutional Party is pretty much just an anti-abortion party these days. But nonetheless, it's almost like he's setting himself up for a third-party run. And then again, Blitzer says, what are the issues? What's your problem with McCain?
I would say it was the issue that motivated me probably a year and a half ago to get involved, and that has to do with our foreign policy and the war in the Middle East, because I see it so damaging to us around the world, as well as something we can't afford, and now we're facing a financial crisis. But I can't get that many allies in Washington. I mean, they are continuing to spend on war and welfare, like there's no economic problem. I mean, any time a problem pops up, the Congress just appropriates more money and the Fed prints more money, and nobody seems to want to slow up.
And, of course, the difference between Ron Paul's perspective on all of this and the Democratic Party's perspective on all this, both are decrying this idea of massive deficit spending that the Reagan administration started, that Dick Cheney said Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter, that the Bush senior administration continued, that Clinton actually pulled back from. Bill Clinton gave us a balanced budget and a surplus. And then the George W. Bush administration has just gone full tilt boogie, taking our total national debt from around $5 trillion up to around $9 trillion. I mean, it's mind-boggling. More debt than every other president in the history of the United States has added together, even more than Reagan did, has been added by George W. Bush, although you could argue if inflation-adjusted, Reagan's still the king of it. But nonetheless, Ron Paul saying, you know, here's the problem. But what he wants to do is he wants to say the solution is to do away with Social Security, Medicare, all kinds of welfare programs, any kind of social programs whatsoever. Let's not have a social safety net. If somebody falls in hard times, if they lose their home, if they get sick, if they get cancer, screw them. That's the Ron Paul. I mean, libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. That's the Ron Paul perspective. The Democratic perspective is let's pay for these things appropriately. Let's reclaim the phrase tax and spend instead of the Republican mantra of borrow from our children and spend. But in any case, we have to bring together the Democratic Party. We have to heal it even now. Your thoughts on how to best heal the Democratic Party right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
For full show podcasts with no commercial interruption, get Air America On Demand, only on AirAmerica.com.
Welcome back. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman here. The Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It's time for change in Washington. You can find out more about it at teamster.org. Just a quick thought from Franklin Roosevelt. And this is the rallying cry, frankly, in my opinion. It should be the rallying cry, one of the rallying cries for the Democratic Party. And we need to be just saying this explicitly. Say this could be one of the things that could bring the Democrats together and help heal this party as well, is to start going after the Republicans, as Franklin Roosevelt did. This is in May of 1940 from one of his fireside chats. May of 1940, he's talking about the present emergency, right? World War II.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
Yeah. And, you know, how eloquent, how brilliant. This is the president of the United States speaking to the people saying this. And on the other hand, Bush, let's give a few more $1 billion to Halliburton. And, they're moving over shore to Dubai so they don't have to pay taxes. And KBR moved to the Cayman Islands so they don't have to pay taxes. And we're making minting war millionaires like there's no tomorrow. This is a great, great topic around which the Democratic Party can rally and bring it back together. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. How do we heal the Democratic Party even now? And frankly, I'm seeing the beginnings of it. I thought this talk by Hillary Clinton, where she said she would enthusiastically support Obama if he's the nominee, he has said the same about her. This is a great beginning. Elliot in Northampton, Mass., listening to WHMP. Hey, Elliot, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Doing? I hope you're feeling totally from whatever you had a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm fine. The pneumonia that I got when I was in Sudan, I'm all over it. What's up?
I was taken by the analogy and the metaphor with the Native American healing, and I've done quite a bit of that myself, and I'm active in with the Progressive Democrats of America, so I'm kind of going in both camps, and I think that you can't heal what's going on in the Democratic Party unless you get to the root. You can't heal anybody unless you get to the root cause. You couldn't, in your example, say just laugh about it with your buddies in that situation and sort of sweep it under the rug. It had to be rooted out with the cause. And in the Democratic case, the cause is the Democratic Leadership Council and what the Clintons began in the 90s or 80s and 90s, which was centrist corporatist leadership of the Democratic Party in opposition to the FDR New Deal type of liberal and more progressive forces at work. Until you root this out and say this is the cancer in the Democratic Party that needs to be rooted out so we can say things like FDR said to the Republicans and heal and bring the progressive forces together with the liberal forces and regenerate the party.
Yeah, I don't disagree with your sentiment, Elliot. The fact of the matter is that the DLC has been waning in influence considerably over the last few years, that in the last two election cycles, those a story much underreported by the media, those Democrats who ran as progressives, whether it was the governor of Montana, Governor Schweitzer, or whether it was in many House races around the country, those who ran as progressives won handily. And we just saw this, again in Mississippi and in Denny Hastert's seat, even where they were using down in Mississippi ads saying, this guy's a friend of Barack Obama's and his pastor was Reverend Wright. Holy cow, how can you have that? That guy still won. And so the bottom line is that the Democratic Party in America, I think, is becoming more progressive and the DLC is losing its influence. It emerged. And to give Bill Clinton some credit, we have to acknowledge that the Democratic Leadership Council emerged at a time when there wasn't the net roots. There wasn't any other way to raise money. The Republicans were out fundraising Democrats, 2, 3, 4, 5 to 1 in many cases. Because corporate America was Republican America. And now their time is gone.
And now this Obama, that's a challenge to that leadership, and even though he's not a progressive in many senses, he would represent represent a defeat for the policies of the Democratic Leadership Council, and they should acknowledge it and step aside.
I don't disagree with you at all, Elliot. And in that regard, it's like, okay, the way you heal is you win. But there is, let's acknowledge, there is a battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And to some extent, it's being played out in Meta in this primary campaign, although Hillary Clinton has been taking more progressive positions in many regards than, for example, with regard to trade agreements, NAFTA and whatnot, than her husband did, and than the DLC does. So it's interesting to see how this shakes out. Ian in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Ian, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Listen, what I wanted to say was on this matter of this gas tax, and maybe you can explain how this is supposed to work. Hillary Clinton is saying that she's going to take the gas tax off at the pump, 18 cents federal gas tax.
Right.
But then she's going to recover the money lost to the Treasury by taxing the oil companies for the same amount, so that we'll still have money to build our bridges, what have you.
Right, with the windfall profits tax.
Right. Well, what I don't get is, and the idea is that the voters are supposed to like this because then they're going to pay less at the pump for their gasoline. It makes no sense because the oil company is going to say, okay, you took it off at the pump, but then you just put that same tax back on us over here on our oil, so we have to pass that tax back through to you, customer, to make up the difference. So, by the way, we can't lower the price of gas at the pump.
Well, and in fact, when in Illinois a number of years ago, and Barack Obama voted for it, the state of Illinois suspended the gas tax for a summer for the driving season. and did something very similar to this, although I'm not even sure that they taxed the oil companies. I think they simply suspended the gas tax. And the result was that the oil companies said, okay, people were paying $2 a gallon. They reduced the gas tax down to $1.90 a gallon or $1.85 a gallon. By reducing the gas tax, they reduced the price down to that. But they said, we know people are willing to pay $2 a gallon, so they just raised the price of gas. Well, and it didn't do any good.
Well, I'd like somebody who supports Clinton and supports this idea she's pushing to please call and explain how taking the tax off at the pump and then turning around and taxing the oil company is going to end up with a lower price to the purchaser at the pump. It makes no sense.
Yeah, well, I don't think it makes sense either, and that's why when John McCain first proposed it, I ridiculed it. When Barack Obama this weekend on Face the Nation, I guess it was, with Tim Russert, said this is pandering. I think he was right, and you know, we'll see. I don't think it's going to be a winning political strategy for Hillary Clinton, unfortunately. Henry in West Virginia. Hey, Henry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
It's not the DLC that's the problem in the party. It's the inability to get past the natural liberal progressive base. If you look at the last two or three elections, where the Democrats have lost, it hasn't been the DLC defecting. It's been the inability to get at the conservatives in the party to even consider it.
I would say in the last couple of elections, what you've seen, and Thomas Frank did a brilliant job of articulating this in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, is that the Democrats allowed the Republicans to frame the issues of the debate, of the elections, you know, with guns, God, and gays, you know, and abortion, and things like that. And while many of these are important issues, they are not the most important issues that America is facing. And also, of course, the Republicans using the, oh, my God, the boogeymen are going to get you. 9/11 is going to come. You know, Dick Cheney, if you vote for a Democrat, they're going to hit us again. It is time, and it is happening, frankly. It's happening both in the Clinton and the Obama campaigns. It is time to take us back to the core issues of America. And that is not what's been happening in the last couple of elections. And I'd say to a large extent, I place a lot of the blame for that at the feet of people like Bob Schrum, these Democratic advisors.
Except Bob Schrum has lost in
seven out of the eight last elections that he ran.
Well, he's lost in ways that traditionally get Democrats elected. And Howard Dean.
No, I disagree. I'd say they have not been talking about the things that traditionally get Democrats elected, and they haven't been talking about them because the Republicans have made liberal a dirty word and have talked about income redistribution and everything, and the Democrats bought that line. They thought that Americans
we bought the 50-state strategy this time, and the 50-state strategy, if it fails to get us the White House this year, we'll never be heard of again.
No, I think the 50-state strategy is doing great, Henry. I mean, you look right across the country. We're seeing, as I said, we spent the weekend with the Secretary of State here in the state of Oregon, Bill Bradbury. And the number of people who are registering to vote in this state and the number of Democrats, and we're 41 or 43% of the registered voters Democrats in the state. It's huge.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
There's a great thread over at DemocratUnderground.com. It was posted by Tatiana. She says she supports Barack Obama after switching from Edwards, put on her walking shoes last week, and decided to just go door-to-door and canvas. And this was in Gary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and was expecting to hear people talk about, you know, oh, we've got to have a gas holiday and Reverend Wright is a terrible thing and blah, blah, blah. Instead, what happened? She said, you know, a man said to me that the gas holiday, tax holiday was stupid and it didn't take anyone with a college degree to figure that out. Another person said it was a shame that Reverend Wright was the focus of the important issues in this election and that Obama probably did not know Wright was like that. She says, I was shocked. I'd gone into this canvassing thing with the idea that I'd have to remind voters of the issues before them and that the whole right situation was just media distractions from the real problems facing the average Americans. But person after person, door after door, what I heard from Hoosiers in both Fort Wayne and especially in Gary was that they didn't care. They didn't care about Reverend Wright. One lady in Gary told me that she went to a church to worship the Lord, not a pastor or her particular opinion. She says the media is full of beep, and they love drama. They want to turn this election into a soap opera for ratings. This is what a voter said to a person doing canvassing. She says, what I ended up learning is that Americans are really smart. She says, I'm a woman of color, both Latina and African American. The neighborhoods I was canvassing were not likely to have many residents of color. I have to say I have never felt so connected, so bonded through shared experiences as I have these past couple of weeks. People want to be able to send their children to college. They want to know that after college there'll be work available for them. People want to be able to watch their partners grow old and be there for them. People want to be able to provide for their spouses, partners, and significant others. Bush economics have really taken a toll on this nation and its citizens. This is, you know, Tatiana posting over at democraticunderground.com. Her what she heard from Democrats as she was canvassing in Gary and Fort Wayne, Indiana. Families are hurting. Children are going hungry. Our elders are unable to retire with dignity. At the last house I visited, before I headed back to headquarters, I met a retired veteran in his 60s. He stepped out onto the porch in a Harley Davidson T-shirt and Bermuda shorts. He told me he didn't give two beeps about the Reverend Wright mess. He said he didn't blame Obama for what Wright had said or done. He said, hell, I voted for Bush twice. People make mistakes. So her summary, she says, take heart, DU. I'm starting to truly believe this time America is going to vote for change. I think the healing is already beginning. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Paul in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, what's happening? How's it going?
Good.
First time calling. Love the show. You're a smart dude.
Thanks.
Just wanted to talk a little bit about that gas tax holiday. I have kind of a selfish interest in this. I'm a land surveyor. And I do a lot of work for the Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. People don't really realize that when you take the gas tax away, just Texas, for example, 75% of their gas tax goes to building roads.
Right. The number that I've heard is that if the gas tax holiday were to extend for 3 months and we're not funded by something, in other words, doing it the way John McCain proposes, 300,000 people would have to be laid off.
Yep, exactly, because of, you know, you can't maintain the infrastructure. The fall has got to come from somewhere, and that's right. Where they're going to cut it.
Exactly.
They're going to cut it from the commons, and
that's right.
That's just going to cost jobs in the long run.
Yeah, and what this meme plays into, and this is why I think it's so unfortunate that Senator Clinton decided to jump on this horse, what it plays into is this larger idea that taxes are somehow some abstract, terrible thing that are imposed on us, and there's no therefore connected to them. The taxes are not the price of admission to civil society. The taxes are not the way that we fund the commons. And increasingly, by simply talking about taxes in the abstract, people are coming to believe that.
Yep.
And it's a tragedy.
Well, people just pay attention to that conservative ideology that, you know, I don't think they really understand that, you know, when you cut taxes somewhere, the money has to come from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Or when you start a new program, well, the money has to come from somewhere, and they just think that it just poofs out of the air. Well, it does the way the Fed prints money, but then
we see, you know, inflation, which is jacking up the cost of gas, which is, you know, and the gas tax holiday
would just cause so much harm. It's not funny. People just don't understand it.
Well said.
They're just going to be happy to get the lower prices. Makes them happy around election time, just like the last election.
But see, they're not going to get the lower prices. First of all, this is not going to happen. Yeah, I, you know, and now is the oil companies manipulating things for their buddy George W. Bush. But the fact of the matter is that gas prices will not go down if you have a gas tax holiday, and it's going to do harm to the country. We have to acknowledge that taxes are the price of admission to a civil society. They actually pay for things. Lillian in South New Jersey. Hey, Lillian.
Hi, hey, thank you for taking my call, Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree totally in the sense that the Democrats are not going to heal that quickly. I live in New Jersey, and it's a Democratic state as a whole. We have a Democratic governor who I'm sure you read or heard about the mess we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I object because these two candidates, one is a blatant liar, Hillary Clinton, and the other is nowhere. I mean, they don't talk on issues. She won't take certain questions. Well, what kind of a debate can you have?
And
we,
really,
I think Lillian, we need to back away from that kind of rhetoric.
Because, well, it's not rhetoric, it's the truth.
Well, you know, I don't think that there's a politician in America where you can't find some place where they've said A and then later said B. Sometimes sincerely, sometimes honestly, they change their minds. I think that, you know, calling people names, basically going for the personal text. I get your point.
She can't be questioned on her record for the last 20 years.
She's questioned on her record all the time. And again, I don't want to be in the position of either defending or promoting Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. My point, particularly with regard to this hour, is that we need to figure out a way. We collectively, Americans first, Democrats second, we collectively need to figure out a way to heal the Democratic Party and our nation. Because if we're going to be an agent of healing for the world, which traditionally the United States has been, or at least we've held it up as an ideal, we haven't always been, then we need to be able to heal ourselves first. That's a big challenge. That's a big job, and it's something that we need to be doing internally. And I think as a party, that healing needs to take place. And frankly, I think in some ways it's beginning with this ramping down of the rhetoric. But also as individuals, as we talk to each other. I mean, people send me these hate-filled spams about Democratic candidates. And I'm like, tell me why I should vote for your candidate, not against the other guy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
Back in 1942, welcome back to the second hour of our program, by the way. Back in 1942, Franklin Roosevelt, during World War II, May 26th, gave a fireside chat in which he talked about those people who would seek to divide America from itself, who would seek to tear us apart. And I just want to share a couple of comments from Franklin Roosevelt about this with you first here.
There is an added technique for weakening a nation at its very roots, for disrupting the entire pattern of life of a people. And it's important that we understand it. The method is simple. First, discord. The dissemination of discord. A group, not too large, a group that may be sectional or racial or political, is encouraged to exploit its prejudices through false slogans and emotional appeals. The aim of those who deliberately egg on these groups is to create confusion of counsel, public indecision, political paralysis, and eventually a state of panic.
A state of panic. And then Roosevelt went on to say,
these dividing forces, I do not hesitate to call undiluted poison. They must not be allowed to spread in the New World as they have in the Old. Our moral, our mental defenses must be raised up as never before against those who would cast a smokescreen across our vision.
David Horowitz is with us. He is the author of a new book, Party of Defeat: How Democrats and Radicals Undermined America's War on Terror Before and After 9/11, along with Ben Johnson. And HorowitzFreedomCenter.org is the website. David is also president of the Horowitz Freedom Center. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Always
David,
a pleasure.
David, why are you using the demagogic language of McCarthy and Stalin that Roosevelt so appropriately denounced in the clip that we just heard, to try to divide Americans along liberal and conservative lines, Democratic and Republican lines, particularly at a time when, if anything, this nation needs to be healed and unified?
Well, the unity of Americans on the war on terror was destroyed by the demagogic attacks, the divide and conquer us attacks of the Democrats. It's Al Gore who accused Bush of betraying the country. It's a Democrat.
George Bush did betray the country, sir.
It's accused Bush. He betrayed us. is what he said, what Gore said.
And yes, I will agree with that. But
and it's the Democrats who accused the commander-in-chief of our forces while they were in harm's way of lying to manipulate us and deceive us into war. That was a Democratic National Committee ad. That claim that Bush lied, people died, is the biggest lie of the war, because every Democrat senator who voted for the war had on his or her desk a 100-page report called the National Intelligence Estimate, which summarized all the intelligence on Iraq. Democrats knew exactly what Bush knew. He didn't lie. And they supported the war, and then they turned against it.
Actually, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against giving Bush the authority to go to war, number one. And number two, the Senate resolution that the majority of Democrats in the Senate voted on said that the president had to certify in writing to Congress that there was a direct connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. And if you go over to whitehouse.gov, you can find the letter that George Bush wrote 90 days after, or 60 days, I guess it was, after the commencement of hostilities, saying that there was an association between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. Later, Bush said,
"We've got no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th."
We have no evidence. Now, which time was he lying? When he wrote to Congress or when he spoke to the American people?
Okay. Democrats had confined their attack to their understanding of that letter versus his, that'd be one thing. But they said that Saddam Hussein was no threat and that Bush manipulated the intelligence information about WMDs.
Actually, it wasn't the Democrats who said that. It was the head of MI5. It was the head of British military intelligence, Richard Strangelove, who said that.
Democratic National Committee ad said, read his lips, President Bush deceives the American people, and it was about the 16 words about the Niger uranium.
Right.
So the fact is that the Democrats conducted a campaign of lies.
But it wasn't a lie. There was no uranium from Niger going to Iraq. That was a lie. Bush knew it was a lie. Colin Powell has come out. He was the guy at the center of this, has come out. Richard Armitage, his assistant, has come out and said, you know, this was a lie.
Both Powell and Armitage opposed the war from the beginning. There were two independent...
They had the information.
Anyway, Tom, there were two independent commissions. One, a bipartisan Senate commission, the other, the Butler Commission, all said that what Bush said was about Niger was absolutely valid and that Joe Wilson was the liar. The issue
we never found the uranium, did we, David?
I mean, Niger has two exports, chickpeas and uranium. Which one do you think that the Iraqis were trying to get?
Well, it turns out it was neither. And it turns out that if you go back and look at what Hans Blix said, if you look at what Mohammed al-Baradei said, when Saddam said, "I'm stopping my program," in 99, he actually stopped his program.
Look, Saddam Hussein was an international outlaw. He had thrown the UN inspectors out. He didn't give them free access.
He did not throw them out. He did give them free access.
What do you mean he didn't throw them out?
Just what I said. Bill Clinton pulled out Scott Ritter when he was heading the inspectors in 99 because there were some areas where it looked like Saddam Hussein was covering things up. Bill Clinton went in and he blew those buildings up. He blew them up. And then when Blick and al-Baradei went in, they had absolutely unlimited access. Hans Blix himself talked about that.
I guess Carl then is with Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and the entire...
Hans Blix himself, the entire
Democratic Congress who voted for the Iraqi Liberation Act because he threw the UN inspectors out.
The Iraqi Liberation Act did not call for bombing Iraq. UN Resolution 14...
11 called for bombing Iraq. The Iraqi Liberation Act called for the violent overthrow of Saddam Hussein and support to any group that would do it.
The word violent was not in that act, first of all, David. And secondly, back to this point, George Bush is the one who pulled Blix and al-Baradei out of Iraq. It was George Bush who pulled them out. It was not Saddam Hussein who kicked them out. In fact, they were saying that they had unlimited access. Blix was...
You know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced they were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them.
You've distracted.
And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence.
And Blix said there was no evidence.
Like all liberals, you don't want to stay on the point. The point was you set this up as who sowed discord. And I showed you that the Democratic Party, the entire Democratic leadership, divided the nation in the war for the first time in American history through a series of lies that Bush manipulated intelligence, concealed it, that Iraq was no threat, and so forth. That is.
So how was Iraq a threat to us?
That's what my book,
David.
Party of Defeat, is about. And I don't expect to have a review in The Nation or any left-wing magazine because they don't deal in arguments. They just deal in labels. And
we're giving you an opportunity to make your case here, David. Well, how was Iraq a threat to the United States that required us to go in and drop bombs on them?
How was Afghanistan a threat on September 10th, 2001? It was a much weaker, poorer country, has half the population, no oil.
Afghanistan was a threat in as much, since you asked, it was a threat in as much as it was a failed state. We should have been supporting them with a Marshall Plan type of program when they threw the Soviets out. I mean, this is the carry-home lesson of Charlie Wilson's war.
It couldn't because of the progressive left and the Democratic Party, which wouldn't allow us to maintain a presence in Afghanistan and build it up.
Well, actually, no, it was the Republicans who opposed our giving financial aid to Afghanistan after they threw out the Soviets. It was the Republicans.
2002, 1 year before the war in Iraq, Al Gore said, he made a speech, and he said, Iraq is a virulent threat in a class by itself, and the United States should do anything necessary to bring Saddam to heel. The betrayal by Al Gore and the Democratic leadership of their own commitment to the war in Iraq is the subject of my book, Party of Defeat.
David, you want to stick around for a minute and we'll wrap this up?
I always have fun with you.
Okay, great. We're talking with David Horowitz. His website, HorowitzFreedomCenter.org. His new book, Party of Defeat, How Democrats and Radicals Undermined America's War on Terror Before and After 9/11. Stick around. 16 minutes past the hour.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
America needs you, Harry Truman. Harry, could you please come home? Things are looking bad. I know you would be mad to see your favorite man.
Yeah, Harry Truman. Well, here's what Harry Truman had to say about all this.
We know that the greatest threat to us does not come from the communists in this country, where they are a noisy but a small and universally despised group. The greatest threat comes from communist imperialism abroad. Now I'm going to tell you how we're not going to fight communism.
Or
jihadism.
We're not
going to transform our fine FBI into a Gestapo secret police. That's what some people would like to do. We're not going to try to control what our people read and say and think. We're not going to turn the United States into a right-wing totalitarian country in order to deal with a left-wing totalitarian threat.
There's Harry Truman. We're talking with David Horowitz, his new book, Party of Defeat, How Democrats and Radicals Undermined America's War on Terror Before and After 9/11, written with Ben Johnson, his website, HorowitzFreedomCenter.org. David, let me just put it right up front. I'd say that what you are doing with this book, and I've spent a fair amount of time with the book. In fact, on page 84, you've got a fairly lengthy quote from Al Gore that I think makes a good case for what I'm saying here, that you, sir, no offense, are dividing America, that you're promoting a fear and divisiveness that is fundamentally anti-American.
This book is an attack on people who divided America, Democrats and radicals. They've been doing it. We're now in 2008. They've been doing it. You guys have been doing it for the last 5 years. Finally, there's a response. You can't accuse the person responding to this divisiveness of doing it. And if you read the book, I say there is legitimate criticism. The criticism of war policy is necessary. And the only people I've accused of actually committing treason in the book are the people who leak classified secrets from the government, who are protected by the New York Times and by the cowardice of the Bush administration, which should have subpoenaed the editors of the Times until they gave up their names.
So how is
the only people that I, you know, that I've done that to?
No, I understand. And but you know, you use words to describe the Democratic Party as anti-American, defeatist. They've lost their patriotism. They're cowards. They neglect America. This betrayal has opened a domestic front in our country's fight for survival. I mean, and at the same time, we've got a president who is saying things like, you know, that...
also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
So Bush says that these unmanned aerial vehicles are going to come to the United States and spread nuclear or biological weapons. At the time he said that, he knew that the unmanned aerial vehicles that had been identified were two balsa wood model airplanes owned by Uday Khusay that were toys.
Well,
he knew that.
Interesting toys, but look, if you... Again, I mean, Bush's speech right before the war in Iraq said very, very clearly that Iraq, he did not regard Iraq as an imminent threat. The whole point was to prevent Iraq from becoming an imminent threat. And that could have been done if Saddam Hussein had just honored the truce in the war and the 17 UN resolutions. And my complaint about the
and he was
is not that it's for peace, but that it's not for peace. There were no demonstrations in front of the Iraqi embassy to demand that Saddam Hussein comply with the arms control.
You realize after 9/11 that in Baghdad there were candlelight vigils in support of the United States the day after 9/11.
Yep.
In Baghdad, and those would not have happened if Saddam Hussein did not allow that.
Of course, we liberated...
Bush had an opportunity to bring us all together, David, and you know, much like Roosevelt brought us together after Pearl Harbor, he had an opportunity to bring us together, and instead he divided us.
On the contrary, it was Tom Daschle who left the meetings. I mean, Bush had meetings with the Democrats. He included them on everything until Daschle began sniping at him outside those meetings. It is the Democrats who have divided the country. That's what this book is about. And I will drop all this rhetoric once the Democrats come back into the fold. But I certainly don't.
How do they come into the, in the 30 seconds we have left, how do they come into the fold, David Horowitz?
Well, I want them to, and I say this in the book, constructive criticism. That is criticism whose spirit is that the United States needs to win this war. We need to deny.
We already won the war.
We need to deny.
Against Iraq.
To Iran. We have a
so we need to bomb Iran.
Islamofascism. Iran is an enemy. I want to see support for a confrontation with Iran over its nuclear weapons.
A military confrontation.
I said a confrontation. You know, Gore began sniping at Bush when he had a diplomatic confrontation, and Jimmy Carter as well, with Saddam. I want a unified front when we're confronting monsters.
Well, I think we're all in favor of a unified front for confronting monsters. And we'll leave it at that with the last word to David Horowitz. David Horowitz, The Party of Defeat, his new book, HorowitzFreedomCenter.org. Thank you, David, for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You never take advice.
So here we were, 2 weeks, well, actually, I was going to say 2 weeks before we invaded Iraq. Actually, the day that we began the bombing, Bush goes on TV and says, basically, we're going to start bombing. You know, we're going to begin this thing. We're coming after you guys. And all of America and all the world was watching. And he said, and then he turned to the camera and he said, and now I'd like to speak to the Iraqi people. And most of us watching, I could certainly speak for myself, were expecting him to say, you know, your kids in uniform are just like our kids in uniform. They're our sons and daughters. We don't want them to die in battle. Our brothers and sisters, our fathers and mothers, we don't want them to die in battle. The United States military machine is the largest in the world. We're going to roll over you guys in a matter of weeks. Just surrender so that there are minimum casualties on both sides, and everything will be fine. And we'll treat you well, and we'll take prisoners of war the way George Washington did. You'll be treated well, and we'll help rebuild the country without Saddam Hussein. That's what we were expecting to hear. Instead, what Bush said was,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And the whole world went, what? So that's what this is all about. And then compare that, contrast that kind of mentality with Franklin Roosevelt during World War II.
It is whispered by some that only by abandoning our freedom, our ideals, our way of life, can we build our defenses adequately, can we match the strength of the aggressors. I did not share those illusions. I do not share these fears. Today we are more realistic. But let us not be calamity howlers and discount our strength. Let us have done with both fears and illusions.
Yeah, let us have done with both fears and illusions. The most important part, let us have done with fears. And McCain, why are we there in Iraq?
My friends, I will have an energy policy that we will be talking about, which will eliminate our dependence on oil from the Middle East, that will prevent us from having ever to send our young men and women into conflict again in the Middle East.
And let us remember what Dick Cheney said just before we invaded Iraq.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
I think everybody in the world pretty much knew what was going on. And now Iran has the third largest reserves in the world. And let's attack Iran. Let's bomb Iran. I mean, it is starting to get downright spooky. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jim in Indiana. Hey, Jim, what's up?
How do you maintain patience with the kind of nonsense the Horowitz dishes out? How do you manage?
You know, I really and truly believe that having grown up in a Republican family, I've told this story before, but maybe you haven't heard it. My father died a year ago, June.
Oh, yeah. I've been listening to you ever since IE America.
Oh, for 6 years then. Yeah, so when I was sitting next to my dad as he was dying, I'm sitting there with my three brothers and my wife and a couple of my sisters-in-law, and dad is drawing his dying breath, and I've got my hand on his shoulder, and I look up, and the wall there next, over him was a picture, all the pictures of the family, of course, and everything, and among them was a picture of me shaking hands with Pope John Paul II, and next to that a picture of George Bush on the USS Abraham Lincoln. My father died a Republican. I have been having these kind of debates with my father ever since he threw me out of the house when I was 16 for opposing the Vietnam War and then, embraced me and brought me back. But the point is that I have learned over the years that it is possible to disagree with somebody and still love them, the case of my father, or disagree with somebody and still acknowledge their humanity, the case of David Horowitz and the other conservatives who come on this program. And I think, frankly, And the reason that I model that so frequently on this program is because I think I truly believe that if we don't start doing that again in this country, like people on the right actually used to, William F. Buckley with his old show Firing Line, when you have liberals on all the time and actually have an intelligent conversation with them. And at the end of the day say, I disagree with you, but I still, I'm glad you're an American just like me. And that's what we need to be doing again in this country. So, I think that it's important that we have the conversation. I think it's important that people on our side hear the other side, because those are the words that are being said, and that somebody is out there modeling how to talk back. So when you talk to the guy in the gas station, when you talk to the guy at the water cooler, when you talk to your brother-in-law over Thanksgiving dinner, you can have the conversation without there being blood on the floor. So that's why I do it. Jim, thank you very much for your kind words. I appreciate it. Scott in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. I also heard the conversation with David Horowitz, and it's my opinion at this point in time that we're going to have to purge the government of the neoconservatives that took control of our government.
I think it's happening. I think we saw the beginning of it in the election of 2006, and I think that we're going to see a huge movement in the 2008 election. Look at what just happened here. We had Denny Hastert's seat just went to a Democrat. We had a guy down in Mississippi, who's running, and they're running ads against him saying he's close to Barack Obama, and Barack Obama, of course, has a pastor, and that pastor seems to like Louis Farrakhan, and holy cow, we can't have that. And the guy won anyway. I think America's waking up. This was in a Republican district.
Yeah. Well, people like Horowitz are content to live in a national security state, which, you know very well Harry Truman put in 1947. And it's a far cry from the country that was founded over 200 years ago.
I will grant you that we've been sliding backwards. We've also moved forward a number of times. I mean, one of the big backwards, I mean, we can go back to John Adams and the Alien Sedition Acts, but the Alien Sedition Acts of World War I, put into place by the Democrat Woodrow Wilson, were horrible. You know, Franklin Roosevelt interning the Japanese. There have been a number of times when we have slid backwards and we have damaged the ideals of this country. Both Democrats and Republicans have done it. We have to acknowledge that history. And it's happening again right now, as you point out, Scott, correctly. And so, therefore, it is so important for us to acknowledge, you know, the dark as well as the light, or the good as well as the bad, or whatever, however you want to say it, and to move forward toward the ideals of this country, toward freedom and liberty. So, Arnold in North Carolina. Hey, Arnold, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man?
Just fine.
I'm sure I listen to you almost every day. My wife said I should be like that guy. He knows how to hold his cool. He don't have no high blood pressure. But listen,
thank you.
About this guy you just interviewed, man, my blood pressure went through the ceiling. You know, it was a radical Democrat that made us, that what he was talking about. It was George Bush himself. George Bush. When he crawled upon that rubble of the World Trade Center,
yeah,
with the bullhorn, he had 91% of the American people behind him, Democrats and Republicans.
Yes.
He was the one who chose to take us down that dark road. He
yes.
was the one who did all these things, not the Democrats.
I absolutely agree. Very well said, Arnold. Thank you. And in fact, in that moment, if George Bush had decided to do the exact same thing that Bill Clinton did when we were attacked by a terrorist who killed hundreds of people in the federal building, in McMurrah Federal Building in Kansas City, I think, or wherever it was. And Bill Clinton said, this act of terror, I'm not quoting Bill Clinton, but in essence, was perpetrated by a crazy person. I mean, we cannot have this. We cannot have, you know, this. We're going to go after this guy. He's a criminal. We're going to take down the criminal. It was Oklahoma City is where it was. And we're going to find this criminal and we're going to prosecute him. And if George Bush had said there is a criminal behind this, this is an insane act. Muslims around the world are denouncing this, and they were. If George Bush had said to the Muslim world, please join us, let's find the people responsible for this and prosecute them in a court of law and bring them to justice, Interpol, the police agencies of Muslim countries, of Arab countries, of every country all around the world. And in fact, even the Taliban said, we'll give you Osama bin Laden if you have any evidence that he's responsible for this so that he can stand trial in a third country. We won't give him to you, America, but we'll give him to a third country. You know, we'll let him stand trial in The Hague. And Bush said, no, no, we don't want that. We'd rather drop bombs on Afghanistan. Well, every country that's ever tried to occupy Afghanistan has had their butt handed to them, including the Soviet Union, and it's happening to us now as well. That was such a horrible mistake. Bush could have pulled this country together, and instead, as you correctly point out, Arnold, he chose to tear us apart. It's tragic. Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening to Wins. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. You know, I'm all for truth and reconciliation in this country, but it has to begin with truth. When you hear an arrogant, pompous deluded liar like Horowitz or Scalia, who was interviewed on C-SPAN over the weekend and doubled down.
You know,
on the same
Charlie,
line.
I just have to stop you. David Horowitz is not here to defend himself, and I just, you know, I really don't think it's appropriate that we attack people, particularly a personal attack, like calling somebody a liar when they're not here.
Deal with facts.
Yeah. So
for
just
him to say that it's the Democrats after we went through that whole impeachment, attempted coup d'etat, Bush is elected, and Bush is the one who wanted, as you just said, go the war route.
Right, and he was not elected, by the way. He was appointed by the Supreme Court.
And planted in the shrub that was planted in the White House by the Supreme Court. And to see Scalia get up 2 weeks running on mainstream television and just outright lie about the 2000 election.
This is incredible. I saw this Scalia last night. I mean, how can he say, well, Bush would have won anyway? When they actually counted the vote in Florida, and it turned out Gore got more votes. I mean, it took them a year to do it, and they buried the story in the 17th paragraph because it was after 9/11 and they didn't want to hurt Bush. But Gore got more votes.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
The magic of America, as articulated by Franklin Roosevelt.
Fortunately, American men and women are not yet easy dupes.
Not yet.
Campaigns of group hatred or class struggle have never made much headway among us and are not making headway now.
Well, that was then, and this is now, and fine thing it was. By the way, strange things on the wire service, as they say, downright crazy, in fact. After a week in which a chorus of television pundits talked about the Reverend Wright controversy ad nauseum, Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama introduced a proposal today to silence such repetitious discussions. Obama told a capacity crowd in Indianapolis, "I am proposing a gas bag holiday. Under my plan, all gas bags would go on vacation until the second week of November." Some observers called the Illinois senator's plan a shrewd one, since in addition to the pundits, it seemed guaranteed to sideline the Reverend Wright himself for the next 4 months. But within minutes of floating the idea of the gas bag holiday, Senator Obama came under fire from several prominent gas bags, including MSNBC's Chris Matthews. Matthews said, "This whole gas bag holiday raises two important questions. How much has the Reverend Wright controversy hurt Barack Obama? And how much has the Reverend Wright controversy hurt Barack Obama?" CNN's senior gas bag Lou Dobbs said, "Senator Obama's proposal of a gas bag holiday should make Americans question his patriotism. The right to be a TV blowhard is as American as wearing a flag pin on your lapel," he said. By the way, isn't Hussein a Mexican name? Thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, for our crazy alert for the day. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dave in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave. What's up?
Oh, hi. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Dave.
I'd like to help Dave Horowitz find out who it was that was dividing the country. You were really good at getting sound bites, and there's one I'd love for you to be able to get your hands on. This was Bush's speech 9 days after 9/11,
right.
Big speech of the country. I was in my favorite local watering hole, so I had no choice over the channel they had it on. They had it on Fox. Hannity and Coles was on. They came on right after the speech. And, you know, Sean Hannity, if you wanted a soundbite of him saying that the Democrats have politicized this from day one, you could get 100 of them. He says,
"Oh yeah, there's no shortage of it." All of these guys are just, you know, they're trying to tear this country apart. I'm telling you, they're trying to divide us one from the other. It's an ongoing process, Dave. It's just an absolute ongoing process. But anyhow, very quickly, the soundbite that you're suggesting I check out.
Yeah, not 10 seconds elapsed after Bush's speech when Sean Hannity said, "Let's see the liberals crawl out from behind this one."
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is so tragic, and
either with us or against us, you're either evil or you're good.
Yeah, why? Because we're opposed to Bush, we're evil? I mean, that it's tragic, it really is. Pete in Easton, Pennsylvania, Hey, Pete.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Love your show. Hey, I know you don't want to get into this, and I'll back off real quick, but I kind of think with this David Horowitz guy, you really are talking to someone that is genuinely paranoid, and you really can't have a reasonable adult conversation with
him. But the reality is, Pete, that, you know, whether it's reasonable or not, if it's unreasonable, then our listeners figure that out. But the reality is that the positions that Horowitz is taking are the positions that are being embraced by a large number of conservatives and neoconservatives. This is
right.
The Bill Kristol stuff. This is the stuff that's making its way onto mainstream television. This is the stuff people are talking about in bars and restaurants and on the shop floor. And somebody needs to confront it. And
I
so here I am.
I'm glad you're doing it. Don't get me wrong. I'm really, really glad you had the guy on. I praise you for it. But I think there are certain elements of our society. Yes, we don't want to stifle their free speech, but they don't deserve a serious debate. In other words, if you have a rabid dog, there's not much you can do about it.
Yeah.
And I really do think that there's a certain benefit to mocking people like that because
I'm not going to mock David as a person. I mean that implies that there's something, you know. I'm just not going to get into personal attacks, but the I would submit to you that these people are hanging themselves with their own words, and they do so on this program fairly regularly. And I trust that my listeners are intelligent enough to figure that out. Steve in Monterey, California, listening to KRXA. Hey, Steve.
Thanks, Tom. I could only take 15 minutes of the heart with vitriol.
Sorry about that,
and though
Steve.
I commend you for delivering him tit for tat.
Yeah.
At the top of the second segment, I had to call a fellow listener of my age to confirm that this was the consumer advocate, David Horowitz.
Yeah, David actually back in the day, he used to be a liberal bomb thrower. He was, and then he became a consumer advocate, and now he's become a conservative activist, shall we say. And you know, he's reinvented himself a couple times, and I'm willing to believe that he's genuinely reinvented himself, and we'll see. Helen in Portland, Maine. Hey, Helen.
Hi, Tom. It's wonderful to talk to you. I was just thinking, if David Horowitz is disgusted with the Democrats dividing this nation, then the polls should make him very happy that over 70% of us now think that the job that he's been doing is just terrible.
Oh, that's right.
So we're actually bringing the country together.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. George Bush and the David Horowitz types and whatnot, they really are uniting this country. Laird and Eureka. Hey, Laird, just about a minute here before we get to wrap up this hour.
Yeah, I understand. And I'm going to need more than a minute.
Well, you know, the machine's going to start in about 40 seconds, and that's it. What's your point?
What's my point?
Sorry, Laird. Ron in Elk Grove, California. Hey, Ron.
It's amazing listening to him. I think to get to the bottom of we have a shameful 6 years of Muslim blood up to our elbows. We got to look at AIPAC bribing Congress, and this is from the John Hagee crypto recruit warmongering school, and where congressmen say, jump and how high, kill and how many.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't see the hand of AIPAC behind this. There's a number of groups that are, as you say, bribing Congress, lobbying Congress. They're one of many. It's what we're looking at here is a hardcore group of neocons who want to go to war against Iran. And frankly, that concerns me. I don't think, you know, we've had enough wars. We've had enough, you know, John McCain, hey, sorry to tell you, we're going to have more wars. No, we've had enough wars.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back to our program. First of all, Tom Hartman here with you. Let me correct something that I said in the last hour. I was wrong, and thank you for the emails. And actually, it was the folks in the chat room who first pointed this out to me. The David Horowitz that we interviewed, the conservative who was once a liberal, is not the David Horowitz who is the consumer advocate. That's a completely different David Horowitz. And I had just always assumed they were the same person. I was wrong. So you can stop the emails. And my apologies to both David Horowitzes, frankly. Larissa Alexandrovna is with us. She is one of the, frankly, and I say this quite seriously, one of the best investigative journalists in the United States, arguably one of the best in the world. Most of her work appears over at rawstory.com. And Larissa was one of the people who first sensitized me to this situation with Don Siegelman. We had an hour-long conversation with him last week or the week before last on the air. We're going to be talking with him this week, is it, Sean? He will be back on the program. And I wanted to get together with Larissa and get an update on what's going on with not just Don Siegelman, but this whole U.S. attorney scandal and some very odd things that are going on. Larissa, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming back and sharing with us the things that you've discovered. There are some really strange things going on around the people who are essentially exposing the politicization of the Justice Department. Here we have the woman who's the husband, who's the wife of the guy who ran Bob Riley's campaign, Lyra Canary. Her husband, Bill Canary, ran the Republican campaign in Alabama, the guy who only won because in the middle of the night, the electronic voting machine suddenly or somehow, you know, in the middle of the night, all these votes were discovered.
Right.
She is one of the attorneys who wasn't fired, and she initiates this prosecution or a chain of events that leads to this prosecution of Don Siegelman for doing something that basically, you know, every president does when they nominate ambassadors, you know, actually even more benign than that. But there are people around the country, particularly in the South, particularly in Alabama and Mississippi, who have been outing the U.S. attorneys, outing the U.S. Justice Department, outing the Bush administration, and in particular Karl Rove's involvement with this, who are having very strange things happen to them. Tell us about this.
Right. Yeah, you have, as you said, two states, Alabama and Mississippi, where two U.S. attorneys in Alabama, as you pointed out, Lyra Canary, in Mississippi, it's Donica Lambton, two attorneys who were not fired. They have cases that they've brought, and people associated with those cases, be it the targets of the cases, the attorneys for the targets, or even a whistleblower, have experienced together, you know, seven people collectively have experienced 10 cases of break-ins, arson. In one incident, the allegations of the whistleblower, Dana Jill Simpson, was driven off the road. And, in fact, if you look at the police report, which we obtained and we have up, there's a police sketch that shows what the police officer documented happened at the scene.
Right. She was basically run off the road and into a parked car.
Right. You can't ignore that she was being driven into a ditch when you look at that sketch. And so you have, you know, these 10 cases, which statistically, you know, are remarkable in themselves. But if you break it down, then it becomes even more strange. For example, Don Siegelman's home was broken into not once, but twice.
And this was not a break-in to steal his jewelry or,
correct,
you know, a Gucci tie or something like that.
Right, right. It, you know, obviously electronics, expensive, you know, things that normally a burglar might take or would take, right, were left undisturbed. What you had, however, is a lot of activity in his home office, and his papers were being rummaged through.
Twice.
But this didn't happen once. It happened twice.
Right.
You know, what are the statistical odds on that? You know, I don't know. But then you have his attorney, Susan James, whose office is burglarized. Again, the same situation where you have computers, expensive office equipment. They even had a liquor cabinet there for their clients. All of that stuff is undisturbed. But what is disturbed in Susan James's office are file cabinets, and those file cabinets are marked with the letter S, obviously, and her client's name is Siegelman.
Right.
So this happens to her several times. You know, so that's just in one case. Then you throw in the same case the whistleblower and what happened to her, and then the odds become...
Being run off the road.
Well, and her house is burnt down 2 weeks before she's run off the road.
Whoa.
Yeah, what happens is she is in January, February of 2007. Dana Jill Simpson is in talks with Siegelman's attorneys about coming forward.
And during these discussions, during one of these discussions, around the time, her house is set on fire. 2 weeks later, she's coming back from speaking with the co-defendant in Siegelman's case, Richard Scrushy. This is when she is the vehicle. Her vehicle is run off the road.
Mm-hmm.
And in our investigation, looking into what happened at the car accident, we went by the police report, and the man listed, Mark Roden, turns out is a former cop.
The man listed as what?
I'm sorry, as the non-contact vehicle, the car that seemed to have been pushing...
The car that ran her off the road, essentially.
Allegedly ran her off the road,
right.
Yes. That was pushing her into the ditch, correct. It is a former cop. And and that's just one case where you have three people this is happening to.
Files being broken into, houses burned down, people being run off the road.
Yeah.
We've seen this before. Donald Segretti was the political mentor of Karl Rove. Donald Segretti helped put together the plumbers unit for Richard Nixon with G. Gordon Liddy and others who were former law enforcement officers, former intelligence service officers, and basically, they burglarized the Democratic National Committee.
Mm-hmm.
There was evidence that they were involved in a whole wider, much wider variety of crimes as well. You had Segretti involved in helping take out and Chuck Colson involved in helping take out, up in New Hampshire rather, to manipulate the Democratic primary so that Nixon would end up running against McGovern.
Well, they broke into the Daniel Ellsberg psychiatrist's office and went through his papers.
Yeah, and so we've seen this movie before.
Right.
Is there any evidence that this is the FBI, Justice Department, law enforcement types who are involved in this, or is the evidence, obviously the second possibility is that it's just all a huge coincidence, or the third, that there's a new plumbers unit operating?
Well, before we go the way of coincidences, I should mention the other set of cases, and that is in Mississippi, where you have another alleged political prosecution. Three of the four targets in the case experience break-ins and arson.
Right.
Okay, and so you have former Judge John Whitfield. His office is burnt down, and not burnt down, but rather set on fire. It actually survives the blaze. And for some reason, the local authorities notify the U.S. Attorney's Office, who promptly sends federal agents in to confiscate all of Whitfield's files. Right.
To confiscate his files rather than to investigate the arson?
Correct. Yes, exactly. Then you have in Paul Miners, the attorney who was one of the co-defendants in this case in Mississippi, who is now serving time in prison. In his case, his office was burglarized. The only thing taken, and he had a suite of offices, the only thing taken was the computer belonging to his the woman who did the accounting and billing for the law firm and, organized all of his personal financial files. That's the only thing taken. No TVs, even though there were TVs. No other computers, just that computer.
Wow. Is your conclusion that we have a plumber's unit operating? We just got 10, 15 seconds here, Larissa.
Okay. I can't say it's my conclusion. I certainly think it raises serious questions. However, experts that I've talked to believe that something incredibly disturbing is going on that would suggest some sort of task force, the way of the plumber.
Official or unofficial?
I don't.
You don't know, yeah.
Don't.
And obviously none of us do, but this is very, very disturbing stuff. You can read about it over at rawstory.com. Larissa Alexandrovna, the investigative reporter there. Larissa, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Even if your hands are shaking,
21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio. And Nora Firm is with us. She is a consultant with the International Labor Rights Forum, the ILRF, their website, laborrights.org. And Nora, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being on with us. This is our regular labor segment here. And you folks are working very, very aggressively to promote the concept of, and this is perfectly apropos for this weekend being Mother's Day, of fair trade flowers, the rights of workers around the world, particularly in Colombia, where a lot of the flowers sold in the United States are grown, to have the rights of organized labor.
That's right. We started this campaign in 2003, and we've been ramping it up since then.
So tell us about the state of labor around the world, and particularly with regard to the flower industry, and what you all are doing with regard to it.
Okay. Well, the most of the roses and carnations that consumers can buy in the United States are produced in Colombia and Ecuador, and they're produced in large greenhouses that actually resembles more of a factory than a farm, if you can imagine that. Each worker is in charge of about 20 flower beds. And most of the workers are women, so that raises a number of issues that we're looking at. One issue is the pesticides that are used on these flower farms are particularly hazardous to women's health. There are a number of reproductive health problems that arise.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to push for less toxic pesticides used in the flower farms and even organic where that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Another issue that arises with the women workers is there's a problem with sexual harassment. A lot of the supervisors are men, and the women may be pressured for sexual favors in order to keep their job.
Yeah. I've spent a fair amount of time in Colombia. It's a very macho society there.
The other problem that arises there is that when women become pregnant, they may be fired. Because the Colombian law says that workers need to be provided with maternity leave, and obviously that makes things more expensive for the employers. So employers would prefer to not keep the pregnant women on, and actually some employers actually require workers, when they apply for jobs, to show proof of a pregnancy test saying that they're not pregnant.
Well, and in fact, if they're handling mutagenic or toxic, hormone-related pesticides, you wouldn't want a pregnant woman handling these flowers in any case.
Yeah,
I mean, she should have a maternity leave, it seems. So to what extent has unionization been successful in the flower industry in Colombia and Ecuador?
Unionization has had a very difficult track record so far. A lot of employers, threaten to fire workers who try to unionize. A lot of workers feel really afraid of even trying because they need to keep these jobs. There aren't very many other jobs available for workers with this skill level and in that region of the country.
Colombia is pretty famous. I mean, this came out of some of the promotion of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement here in the United States. It was released that in Colombia, unique among all the rest of the world, they seem to have the highest, at least per capita rate, of murders of labor leaders. Is that happening in the flower industry as well?
You know, there actually haven't been any murders of unionists in the flower industry so far, but last year there were incidents near Medellin. Some workers tried to unionize at a flower farm there and received death threats from the paramilitary. So they definitely are subject to the same pressures as the other industries. It's just, fortunately, fingers crossed, none of the murders have happened yet in that particular industry.
Yeah. So what are you doing? We're talking, by the way, we're talking with Nora Firm. She is a consultant with the International Labor Rights Forum, the ILRF, their website, laborrights.org. What are you doing and what can we do to support that?
Well, one of the things we're doing is a campaign looking at what's happening in the farms that are owned by Dole Foods. So that's
the Dole Pineapple Company.
Exactly. They actually own a number of flower farms in Colombia, and they are one of the worst violators of union rights there. So we have a consumer campaign asking people to pressure Dole to negotiate with the union and allow workers to organize.
What kind of response have you gotten so far?
Well, they are definitely vulnerable to attacks on their public image. So, they have been willing to dialogue so far, but in terms of actual changes at the farm level, we haven't seen any real advancements yet.
Is there a public face for Dole in the United States? I mean, you know, it's easy enough to, for somebody to call their congressman, but how do you contact or lobby a big corporation? You know, like
yeah,
Dole,
that's been really difficult. And actually, you know, they don't put the Dole label on their flour, so that makes things really difficult. But they are a part of international groups like Social Accountability International, mm-hmm. so they do care about appearing to be a company that is socially responsible.
That's a good first step. It's a good first step.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that you could do when you buy flowers is ask, are these fair trade flowers?
Yes, that's really important. A lot of florists, you know, they won't stock those flowers unless there's consumer demand. Just bringing it to the florist's attention is really important, and letting them know that there are consumers who care about these issues and who want to know where the flowers came from and how they were produced.
Right. There's a certification, fair trade certified flowers. So, Nora, thanks so much for being with us. Nora Firm of the International Labor Rights Forum, laborrights.org is the website. Keep up the great work, Nora.
Thank you very much.
27 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your calls right after this break.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Oh, it's getting downright strange out there. Time for our rush alert for the day.
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuss.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi. He's a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class.
I'm
a fat conservative butthead with the face of a horse's ass.
Yeah. He's a fat conservative butthead.
Hey,
the face of a horse's
Rush Limbaugh alert for the day. It turns out Limbaugh is talking about Bill Clinton, right? This is just, you know, 15 minutes ago on Fox News or so. And a tip of the hat to Christy Harvey, by the way, for from the Center for American Progress. And Limbaugh says that Bill Clinton was trying to hit on his date. And they used Mayor Villagrosa as a distract. Well, here it is.
Actually. He came over three or four times. He had Ron Burkle with him and the mayor of Los Angeles, who I thought was either the shoeshine guy or a Secret Service agent. And he was going on and on and on about how he loved me, had to talk to me.
Yeah, so our Limbaugh alert for the day.
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob.
Evil, rotten.
I'm the cop of Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob.
36 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Pablo in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Pablo, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to go in a little further with what you were talking about, how Bush handled 9/11. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, as horrible as that was, it was probably the most globally unifying event in modern history, not all of history. And the opportunity was there to unite the world against a common cause, whether it be terrorism or, you know, try to promote peace instead of, and look and see what hate has been doing to the world. And
yes.
he blew it so badly. And it's like an opportunity like that is never going to come around again. And, you know, that just infuriates me to think that he was at the helm when that happened. I just wonder what would have happened if somebody with any kind of wisdom would have been there and could have done something with what was given to him, you know?
Yeah, I agree. It was a tragedy for the United States. It was a tragedy for the world. And I think that the reason that it got played out the way it did and thanks, Paolo, for pointing that out, as instead of using 9/11 as an opportunity to bring us all together, because as you correctly point out, Pablo, the world was united on 9/12. I mean, there was shock and horror all over the world, including in Muslim, Arabic, Islamic countries, and non-Arab Muslim countries, you know, from Indonesia to Tehran to Baghdad to Saudi Arabia, all over the world. And obviously Europe, I mean, even the French, you know, it's Le Mans. We are all Americans now. I mean, all across the world, South America, Central America, Africa, all across the world, people were like,
This is horrible. We're with you. But it is not in his constitution to pull people together. George Bush is not a man of peace. And I'm not saying this like some kind of, you know, it was weird. You know, over the weekend I talked about our driving back from Coquille, from the southern Oregon seacoast. It was about a five-hour drive home. And listening to all these right-wingers on the various and multiple right-wing channels that we heard on XM. But the, and terrestrial radio too, for that matter. I don't mean this in the kind of slash and burn personal attack that I was hearing directed against Barack Obama. Oh, he's a secret Muslim, or against Hillary Clinton. Oh, she's, you know, a castrator kind of thing. At least by implication, you know, Tucker Carlson talking about how he tightens his legs together whenever he hears her talk, things like that. I mean, these are just horrible, horrible personal attacks. I believe I'm accomplishing not putting what I have to say about George Bush in that category. This is not a gratuitous personal swipe or an attempt to dump him into some broad, awful category. It's just not his nature to be a consensus builder and a peacemaker. His cabinet meetings, and we know this from the reports of members of his cabinet who have gone on to write books about it. His cabinet meetings were not about gathering consensus. It was his way or the highway when he was paying attention. And, for example, with Katrina, it took them 4 days. It took him 4 days to find out what was going on. Instead, he was out in Arizona cutting birthday cakes with John McCain and yucking it up and having parties as people were drowning. And finally, three members of his staff had to put together a collection of videos from news reports and force him to watch it. I mean, he is not a peacemaker. He never has been a peacemaker. There was all this propaganda about how, well, when he was in Texas, he brought together the Democrats and the Republicans. The fact of the matter is that the governor of Texas, arguably unique among the states, has the weakest or one of the weakest governorships in the United States. The legislature in Texas holds the power. The governor is virtually a figurehead in Texas. He had no choice but to go along with what the House and Senate Republican and Democratic leaderships were all about in Texas. And so it wasn't a matter of leadership by bringing people together. Instead, his personality is very much that you're either with us or you're against us. You're either evil or you're good. He's a binary thinker. He's a person who sees the world in absolute black and white. You're either this or you're that. There's nothing in between. And he did not see 9/11 as an opportunity to bring us together. And all the more the tragedy, not just for the United States, but for the world, because now millions of people are dead as a consequence of his worldview and his reaction to 9/11, and hundreds of millions, arguably billions of people around the world are looking at the United States in a very different way than they were 6 years ago, in a very negative way when they were perceiving us before then, and in a very positive way. So it's frankly a tragedy. Joe in Sacramento. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Oh, yeah, hi, Tom. Talking about break-ins, I want to relate a little story to you and your listeners here. And hopefully the person that I'll be talking about is listening and can call in and give you more info. This is a break-in that occurred about 8 years ago here in the San Francisco Bay Area. It was either in Arundo or Lafayette. I think you're familiar with that region. And this gentleman was collecting, through the Freedom of Information Act, all kinds of documents and records on then-Governor Bush. Now, this break-in occurred in late spring or early summer of 2000. So about 6 months before the election, he was accumulating documents and records on George W. Bush, I believe Jeb Bush, and maybe even on his father. He had a couple boxes, two or three boxes of these records. Someone broke into his house, took nothing but those documents out of his house, touched nothing else, and got away. The police went, what's that?
I was going to say, and in addition to that, there was the very suspicious suicide of Hatfield, the guy who wrote the book, I think it's called Fortunate Son, about George W. Bush that laid out his cocaine arrest and you know, first broke that story. And I mean, there has been no shortage of those kinds of things going on around the Bush administration.
And this happened 8 years ago. This is before he was even elected. And the police, when they came to this guy's house to investigate it, they said, hey, professional job, no doubt about it. And I never heard this story. The only time I heard this story was on the local news one time here out of San Francisco. I think it was Channel 2. and never heard it at all.
Right, and then they drop, and then they drop into the memory hole. No, spot on, Joe. And this is not, you know, Vince Foster weird paranoia promoted by, you know, Richard Mellon Scaife. I mean, these are, like you said, these are news reports. You just look at the news reports and start adding 1 + 1 + 1, and pretty soon you go, oh, that looks like a 3. Bonnie, and thanks a lot for the call, Joe. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Tom. According to the last hour, you had a caller, and you seemed optimistic that the neocons are being purged from government. And assuming the Dems overcome the corporate media, who want a close race, which makes it difficult to overcome the corrupt voting machines and all the dirty tricks, and we get a Democratic president, how does that president deal with all the civil servants that were chosen for their loyalty to this administration? In other words, the neocons illegally politicized the civil servants hiring process, and now we have all these Republican toadies that you just can't fire. There, so how do we deal with that?
Well, some of them you can't fire. Some of them you certainly can. I mean, that's how Bush got many of them in. That's a concern, Bonnie. My bigger concern is the federal judges. I mean, more than half of all federal judges right now, and there, I don't know how many there are, but there's a lot of federal judges. I'm not talking about just, you know, the appeals court and the prosecutors. Well, the prosecutors are not judges, but more than half of them now have been appointed by one of three Republican presidents.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them, probably the majority of them, are Federalist Society members and right-wing ideologues. And that is a very big concern for me. I think it's a huge one. Greg in San Juan Island, Washington. Hey, Greg, just about a minute before the break. What's up?
Bravo, Tom, for your coverage and framing of just every show is fantastic.
Thank you.
Two years I've been listening daily. And I just, the issue of unity, that whether it's a Democratic Party or the country or just unity of purpose in general, the native concept of all my relations.
Mm-hmm.
I just think we need to focus on that and possibly focus on progress might mean slowing down a little bit and a little more the day after the 4th of July being a /Dependence Day.
Yeah, a time for reflection and gaining perspective and looking back and going within and perhaps living in the now a little bit more. And being a little less frightened, you know, as Franklin Roosevelt said.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And that's basically the only thing Bush has to sell.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Nine and a half minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, supporting your local radio station. Give them a call, say hi, let them know you're listening, ask them for a bumper sticker to put on your car. Some of them have refrigerator magnets and things you can pass out to your friends. I mean, spread the word. Spread the word. Speaking of spreading the word, Ellen Ranner with the Talk Radio News Service, now the International Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, calling from the International Bureau of the Talk Radio News Service in Dubai. The new home of Halliburton. Hey, Ellen.
No, actually, Halliburton is in Abu Dhabi, which is a two-hour drive.
Oh, okay. And that's a different Emirates, right?
There's seven Emirates.
Ah.
And Abu Dhabi and Dubai are two of the seven.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to be going to Abu Dhabi just in a few hours. But, okay.
Oh, interesting.
I think the gas prices is certainly what has everybody's attention, both here and in the United States. Today, the president said that, you know, there really wasn't any quick fix. There was a briefing this morning at the White House, and then there was a briefing this afternoon at the White House. Again, they went over this, the president and what they're saying. They were asked this afternoon at the White House, well, what about drilling off the coast of Florida, which, of course, because of Jeb Bush, the president had said absolutely not,
right.
Although he didn't say that was because of Jeb Bush. But now, asked about it again, the White House would only say, well, had we been drilling in the Anwar, there would have been millions of barrels a day that we could have been using at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the...
But, you know, Barack Obama made a good point, I think, over the weekend on Tim Russert's show, Face the Nation, that they had tried this in Illinois. In fact, he voted for it originally, back 5-6 years ago, something like that, when gas was $2 a gallon, of reducing, for the summer driving period, reducing the state tax on gasoline. And he said, you know, whatever number of pennies the state tax reduced the price by, the oil company simply jacked the price back up to where it was. And the consumers didn't notice any change, you know, because the oil companies already knew people were willing to pay that for it.
Well, and then they'll say that people are driving more, too. So both of those things do happen. That's true. One of the – a couple other interesting – well, many interesting things going on at this point, but that the ACLU has been putting out a call. They think that the Democrats are going to cave on the FISA deal again.
Yeah, I just got that in email, and in fact, we're trying to book somebody for tomorrow on that topic, because apparently Jay Rockefeller, the Democratic senator from West Virginia, is in bed with the Bushies on this.
Oh, he absolutely is, and he has been from the get-go, and nobody can understand why.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's not like Jay Rockefeller needs campaign contributions.
And he's on
the Senate Intelligence Committee, so you would think that he would have a commitment to good, clean intelligence that is legally conducted.
I have no idea. And I think what we'll do is we'll have somebody from our office call Rockefeller's office, and maybe you can, too, and find out exactly why they're coming up with what they're coming up with.
Yeah, what's their rationale? I'd love to hear that. And in fact, we'll invite the senator to come on the program if he's willing to discuss it. But I can pretty much predict in advance that...
He's not going to be willing to come out to talk about it.
You know, the senators, by and large, they say when you contact them, they say, yes, we'll come on if you don't ask tough questions, if you don't talk about, and here's the list of 11 topics we won't talk about. And the only senator who will come on this program, you know, with absolutely no preconditions whatsoever is Bernie Sanders. And so he's pretty much the only senator that I'll have on the air, because I'm not going to put up with it.
No,
we don't do suck-up interviews on this show. I'm sorry.
Exactly. Some other interesting news going on this week. There is some intellectual property crimes that they're trying to really get through, that John Conyers is trying to get through. Of course, the Bushies and other people are not as excited about that. Why am I not surprised? But that they're trying to get that through. It looks like the war supplemental is trying to get that package through this week, and they'll be trying to add the food aid to that. So that's going to go on. Then there is China apparently announced another big increase in their defense budget. And they said it would raise almost 18% to $58 billion. Well, the White House and Pentagon says it's more like $100 to $150 billion. But look how many people in China there are in China. Look how big the country is. And our budget is well over six, if you include Iraq, $600 billion. And even if you take the Pentagon's estimate of $150 billion, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, we spend more on defense than every other country in the world combined.
Combined, absolutely.
Which is, I think, from the point of view of most Americans, insane. It's absolutely nonsensical. It is the industry
also
that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about.
Absolutely. And something very interesting, Mrs. Bush in about 5 minutes is going to be speaking about Burma and Myanmar and their humanitarian crisis over there, but also their political crisis. She's actually going to be speaking in the press room. I think maybe that's happened twice in the 7.5 years
that
the Bushes have been there.
For our listeners who don't know, Myanmar is the modern name of what we used to call Burma. I've been on the old Burmese border. In fact, it was just 7 years ago, where the Karen refugees, the indigenous people.
In Chiang Rai.
It was about 30 miles out of Chiang Mai. We're right there on the border where the Karen is the name of the tribe. These indigenous refugees were fleeing from Burma because the army was coming in and just, you know, killing and raping, and because they were talking about independence. They were pushing back, you know, as indigenous people by and large, and the Burmese government is one of the most repressive in the world. So it's going to be interesting to see if this disaster opens up Burma at all.
It'll be very interesting. Last but not least, the Senate's going to be having a hearing on Wednesday about whether politics is interfering with science at the EPA. Shock of the century.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen Radner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Ellen, for the call from Dubai.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Dan Gaynor, about the global food crisis and ethanol. And, of course, all the election news out of Indiana, North Carolina primaries. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. It all begins with each one of us individually getting out there and getting active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.